From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, as the crisis in Haiti continues, we step back from current events to get a historical look at the island. We'll hear about the successful slave rebellion that won the island independence in 1804 and about the legacy of the U.S. military occupation of the early 1900s. We'll talk with Patrick Bellegarde Smith, head of the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He grew up in Haiti under the Duvalier dictatorship. Also, growing up female with the mass media, we talk with Susan Douglas about her new book, Where the Girls Are. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new Rolling Stones album, Voodoo Lounge. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The United Nations says it's giving in to Haitian orders to pull out its team of human rights observers. A UN spokesman says the organization will withdraw its staff of about 100 in the next day or two. The spokesman says the Organization of American States is going along with the UN decision. The observers have been part of a joint UN-OAS team. Meanwhile, the United Nations Security Council is discussing Haiti today. The 15-nation council has condemned Haiti for ordering these expulsions. At the 4th of July Plaza today in Berlin, President Clinton watched the last U.S. military parade and deactivated the brigade of American troops that's been in the city since World War II. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The Berlin Brigade is the U.S. contingent of the Allied troops that came to Berlin as liberators and stayed on as protectors. Their deactivation marks the end of an era in U.S. military involvement in Europe. The president thanked the troops for a mission accomplished.
More than anyone, they showed the patience it took to win the Cold War. More than anyone, they knew the dangers of a world on edge. They would have been the first casualties in the world's final war, yet they never flinched.
100,000 U.S. troops will remain in Europe, but the Berlin Brigade is scheduled to leave the city this fall, along with the other Allied and Russian troops who have been here since World War II ended. In Berlin, I'm Mara Liasson.
Outgoing Budget Director Leon Panetta has released new budget deficit estimates. He's going to the White House to become President Clinton's new chief of staff shortly, UPI's Carol Van Dam reports.
In his mid-session review, Panetta credits the president's five-year deficit reduction plan as being largely responsible for trimming the projected $700 billion deficit.
Our deficit for 1994 will be $220 billion, or $85 billion below what we had projected as the deficit for 94, where we were headed.
For fiscal 1995, Panetta predicts the deficit to decline to $167 billion. That's $135 billion below the projected deficit before the president's budget was adopted. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
Volunteers are helping city workers in Bainbridge, Georgia, to protect vital buildings that are threatened by flooding. The city is in the path of surging floodwaters that have already killed 28 people in the state. Georgia's Flint River is now 11 feet above flood stage in Bainbridge. It is expected to swell another 9 feet before cresting on Thursday. 175,000 people in Georgia have lost their drinking water. The Red Cross says that 7,500 families have been forced out of their homes. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 2 points to 3,700.72. Trading is heavy. 239 million shares have changed hands. This is NPR. Thousands of United Rubber workers are on strike against the Bridgestone-Firestone Tire Company. About 4,200 workers from plants in Illinois, Iowa, Oklahoma, Indiana, and Ohio have worked without a contract since April. Bridgestone-Firestone facilities in other states and in Quebec are not affected by the walkout. A spokesman for the Japanese-owned company says management is willing to meet with mediators at any time. PLO Chief Yasser Arafat is settling in Gaza today after 25 years in exile. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Arafat returned to Gaza today from Egypt. A week ago, he visited Gaza and Jericho as the exiled leader of a guerrilla movement. Today, he's taking up residence as the man expected to run limited self-rule in the two areas. He faces enormous problems such as unemployment, said to be at least 40% in Gaza, and a lack of decent housing, water, and sewer facilities. Many Palestinians are not sure Arafat can make the transition from celebrity exile to administrator, and Arafat continues to talk about more than local government. At a going-away ceremony yesterday in Tunis, the former headquarters of the PLO, Arafat promised to create an independent Palestine with Jerusalem as its capital. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
A wildfire that killed 14 firefighters in Colorado is finally under control, but blazes are still raging in remote areas around Colorado and several other western states. A federal official says a month of 100-degree temperatures and more in Arizona is helping to stoke flames of 11 fires. The blazes have scorched 63,000 acres. Officials say there just aren't enough firefighters to cope. In Washington state, firefighters are hoping for better conditions today while they try to contain a blaze in a state park near Spokane. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Haiti is expelling UN human rights monitors. It's still unclear whether the Clinton administration plans to invade. The U.S. has 14 warships in waters near Haiti, enforcing the trade embargo and carrying 2,000 Marines. It's impossible to understand Haiti without understanding its unique history and its unique relationship to Africa and America. My guest, Patrick Bellegarde-Smith, is the director of the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He grew up in Haiti under the dictatorship of François Papadoc Duvalier. Bellegarde-Smith is the author of the book Haiti, The Breached Citadel. His previous book, In the Shadow of Powers, is about his grandfather, the late Haitian social philosopher Dantes Bellegarde. Back in 1915, the U.S. began a military occupation of Haiti, which lasted until 1934. I asked Patrick Bellegarde-Smith about the legacy of that occupation.
Well, there are a number of legacies from that occupation. The most powerful legacy is the Haitian army. It was created by the U.S. Marine Corps. It was officered by the Marine Corps. Haitian military officers since that time, the early part of the century, have been trained in the U.S. or in Haiti by Americans. That is the most lasting legacy. Another legacy is that of distrust that has existed in Haiti towards the United States, because the U.S. imported to Haiti a very special brand, an Anglo-Saxon brand of racism, something that Haitians were not much, they were aware of it, but they had not stumbled upon it in a very real sense. And this has transformed Haiti. In fact, that military occupation of the country is the watershed event in Haitian, modern Haitian history, and it propels Haiti into the 20th century in that sense. It's a clear break with the past, with the Haitian past, and Haiti has not recovered yet.
What were the reasons for the United States invasion of Haiti?
The United States has had its mind to get a particular port in northwest Haiti, the Mall Saint-Nicolas, opposite Guantanamo Bay. And as you know, Guantanamo Bay will revert to Cuba by the end of this century. In the 1890s, there were a great deal of effort, diplomatic effort, from the part of the U.S. to acquire that piece of territory, which is probably the best natural port in the entire Caribbean area. And Haitians have resisted, and to this date, they have succeeded in resisting those advances. Also, the plan to invade Haiti had been drafted years ahead of time. In fact, the papers had been typed, and the date was left in blank, so that at the slightest provocation, the Marines would have an excuse to come down. There were economic interests. There was, from the part of American businessmen in Haiti, there are today as well. There was also the desire to stop further growth of German economic interests in the country. And so it was, there were a number of reasons for that. But in the final analysis, I think economic interests, as well as the defense of the Panama Canal, which was to be built, was instrumental in wanting to secure Haiti as a kind of a base.
How much do you think that 19-year American military occupation of Haiti shaped the relationship between Haiti and the U.S.?
It has, because up to that point, Granted that the import-export trade with the U.S. was growing and had become so substantial as to provide a majority of the commerce of Haiti in between the U.S. and Haiti, up to that point, at least in diplomatic terms and political terms, Germany had an impact. France certainly had a powerful presence. England did as well. After the U.S. occupation of Haiti, the relationship is bilateral. It's Haiti, U.S., and the European powers fall to the wayside. So Haiti, as a result, loses a great deal of independence because it is not able to play one against the other any longer. It becomes firmly placed in the orbit of the United States economically as well as politically. The Haitian reaction to that was to mount a guerrilla effort. Maybe as many as 50,000 Haitians may have died in various ways, not direct military involvement, but in other ways as well. And there are people still alive who remember that period of time. And so people are very nervous about the possibility of a new invasion because the Marine Corps was absolutely brutal, absolutely brutal.
So there was a guerrilla war against the
yes,
U.S. occupation.
Yes, yes.
Do you think there's ambivalence in Haiti about the possibility of United States intervening there?
Yes, a great deal of ambivalence. People are split on this issue. Haitians will not, even those who might favor an intervention because we are unable at this point to solve our problems, would not say it publicly. People are deeply divided over this issue on all camps, actually. It's not just the peasantry and the urban working class that supports President Aristide or the small Haitian elites. Everybody seems to be divided enough two minds on this particular in this particular area.
Explain the division between the two minds.
Well, on the one hand, we realize that a solution is nowhere in the offing because a small percentage of population, perhaps at most 5%, resist the desires of 90-95% of the Haitian population. And that 5% happens to have all the power now at its command. So that since those situations cannot be resolved very easily, the army is solidly entrenched, does not show any signs of wanting to leave the seat of power, then individuals have told me, well, perhaps that's the only way out. All my life as an academician, I have written about Haitian foreign policy and international relations. And I have always argued that the way to go for Haiti and countries of that size, keeping in mind that Haiti is one of the giant countries of the Caribbean, it's a huge country if one compares it to others, is to go the collective security route. By collective security, I mean very simply that one has to rely for national defense, not on one's own means, not on the Haitian army, which I think is unnecessary, quite frankly. It could not mount a defense if it had to, but on the Organization of American States, on the United Nations, and whatever other international organizations are erected for that purpose. But I would find it difficult, personally, for all kinds of reasons, to see the U.S. go in and certainly go in alone. I have a problem with that. As a Haitian, I would have a big problem with that.
And what's your problem?
No one wants to be invaded by a foreign army. It's degrading. It's insulting. It's humiliating. And this came to me full force when a young 20-year-old Marine Corps was interviewed, I think it might have been CNN, this past week. He was on his way to Haiti, and his contempt that was quite visible, I think he had returned from Somalia and elsewhere, his contempt was obvious, and I remembered, I was not born then, but I remembered the stories of 1915 and what those young Marines did to Haiti. Unless they are solidly instructed, they might turn out to do the same thing. There was utter contempt in his voice.
My guest is Patrick Bellegarde-Smith. He's the head of the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Maybe it would be helpful for us if you gave us a sense of where you think Haiti fits into the African diaspora.
Well, Haiti is clearly the most African of American states, of American nation states. And Haiti becomes terribly significant in the context of the African diaspora, and universally as well, because it was the first country of African origin, modern country of African origin, to have come about 200 years ago. It was the only place in human history where enslaved people were able to free themselves and make it stick. And Haitians are, of course, proud of that. And whereby the American Revolution or the French Revolution were not about freedom. They were not about anti-slavery movements. The Haitian Revolution was about the destruction of slavery, not just in Haiti, but everywhere else.
Yeah, Haiti won its independence in 1804 after a 13-year slave revolt.
Yes, yes, and about 100,000 Haitians died in the process. It was a very murderous war.
This is, I guess, the most successful slave revolt in history?
That was the only successful slave revolt. The closest we get to it is Spartacus in Rome, and he did not succeed.
What made this revolt successful?
The desire of African-born Haitians, because the majority of Haitians in the 18th century, at the time of that revolt, of that revolution, distinguishing it from a revolt, were born in Africa. The desire that they had collectively to become free and to eradicate slavery. Also, much of the leadership had been trained militarily by the French. Those were individuals who had been part of the colonial French army in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was then called. These are individuals, when they were youngsters, I mean in their early teens, late teens, had traveled to the United States and fought for U.S. independence, notably at the Battle of Savannah, Georgia in 1789, under General Rochambeau, the French general, when France had a great many troops in the U.S., helping U.S. achieve its own independence. There has always been the desire for freedom in the country. And in fact, after independence was achieved in 1804, the population remained restive because power was wrestled away from it by emerging budding elites, those very same elites who in 1994 are still in control of Haiti. All the revolts and uprisings that we see over the course of the last two centuries are, I think, directly connected to what had transpired 200 years ago. It is part of that same struggle.
Well, how did elites win control of Haiti after a successful uprising, a successful slave revolt?
Well, those who became the present-day elites aligned themselves with the enslaved Africans when they attempted to engineer a grand alliance with the French. But the French were blinded by their own racism and refused to make an alliance with black and mulatto slave owners, because these people had slaves of their own. You had black slave owners in Haiti, and they wanted the preservation of slavery, and they wanted to get a better deal from the French.
So the more powerful black people who own slaves in Haiti, teamed up with the slaves,
yes,
during the
uh-huh.
slave revolt, and then basically tyrannized them afterwards?
Yes, exactly. That's what happened. And this process was completed essentially by 1844. Up to that point, there might have been a chance. In 1806, you have the assassination of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who is our George Washington, assassination by these emerging budding elites. Between 1806 and 1844, when there is a massive uprising in the south of Haiti from the part of the peasants wanting to control the country, you have the consolidation of upper class, what essentially is an upper class society, pro-French in its outlook, pro-Western in its outlook, pro-Christian in its outlook, against a population which is not French, which is not Western, which is not Catholic, which is not Christian.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patrick Bellegarde-Smith. He's the head of the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and has written a lot about Haiti. He is Haitian. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Patrick Bellegarde-Smith, head of the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's Haitian and has written extensively about the history of Haiti. So in Haiti, you get a very African culture because in 1804, when the blacks win the revolt, a lot of the black people there are Africans. I mean, they weren't born in Haiti. They were born in Africa.
Many of them were born in Africa. Some, obviously, were born in Haiti as well.
What are the most obvious traces now of African culture in Haiti?
The most obvious traits of African culture in Haiti come from the two most major significant elements in any culture, and that is religion and language. The Haitian national religion is what we call here, and we got that name from Hollywood, not from ourselves, voodoo. It's a national religion. Recognized as such by most Haitians, although it was underground up to recently, not allowed, though practiced by just about everybody, including members of that elite that we talk about. And the language, which is at its base in terms of its syntax and grammar, overwhelmingly a West African language related to Fon and to Ewe of West Africa, but whose vocabulary is overwhelmingly derived from French and Old French. Those are the two major elements in Haitian culture, in any culture, that give Haiti its special position in the Western Hemisphaire.
What are the connections between voodoo and African religion?
Voodoo is an African religion. In terms of its ethos, in terms of the rituals, in terms of the belief system that encompass all areas of life, not just religion. A religion in Haiti, as religion in Africa, on the African continent, is not something apart from the rest of the culture, apart from the rest of society. It is well integrated into everyday life. People who practice the religion, which is the overwhelming majority of the Haitian people, would say very simply, I serve the spirits, that's all. I serve the spirit. There is not a particular word. It's not I practice voodoo. I serve the spirits.
The deposed president, Aristide, is a Roman Catholic priest. Does his position in Haiti represent a change in the position of the church in Haiti?
Oh, no, not at all. The church does not like him, has never liked him, mm-hmm. has tried to muzzle him. Aristide has done something somewhat unusual for a man in his position. The priesthood, as the military, is an avenue for social mobility in Haiti. If you come from poor background, from working class background or a background of the peasantry, which he does, the way to escape that particular status is to become either a priest or a military officer. What he has done, however, he has never reneged his social origin. He understands the people, he is from the people, which is why the people are so enthusiastic about him. He has not left them when he became a priest. He has stayed right alongside them. And that makes him an unusual man, very unusual. Therefore, not to be trusted by the elites, because they allowed him to become a priest. He should have left these people behind. He has not.
You grew up in Haiti, so I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your experiences there. Let me ask you first about your grandfather, Dante Bellegarde, who is mm-hmm. a social philosopher in Haiti. What's his importance in Haitian history?
My grandfather was one of two major social philosophers of the first part of the century. His very close friend, Jean Price-Mars, represented the other tendency in Haitian life and culture. My grandfather represented the pro-Western forces, the pro-French, the pro-capitalist, the anti-communist forces, the pro-Christian. Jean Price-Mars emphasized a bit more readily the African content of Haitian culture. So they gave rise to very different movements in that sense.
I'm wondering if you grew up in a wealthy, privileged family in Haiti.
Very much so.
And if you ever politically rebelled against them.
Oh, yes, very much so. I have friends that won't talk to me anymore as a result. The Haitian social structure is very intricate, very involved. We have about 300 millionaires or so, multimillionaires, in that country. At the other end of the spectrum, the per capita income, world per capita income, is about $150 a year. I came from a very privileged background, highly educated background. We did not have money. By Haitian standards, I suppose we did. By American standards, we were poor. But let's put it this way. The word that comes to mind, which is not entirely appropriate, is the word aristocracy. That's the word that comes to mind. As distinguished from those with money, the elites with money, that would be called, with that French word, bourgeoisie. And some of these individuals came from the middle class, obviously, over the last 30 or so years. We never had any money as such. By Haitian standards, we did, though.
Was there a political turning point in your life that was behind your political shift and your split with the family? Did it have anything to do with being educated abroad?
No, it started in Haiti proper, where I saw very little rhyme or reason in the social discrimination that I observed when it was not really possible for me to have friends in the middle class, because we ought not to talk to people like that. And I rebelled at that time, and I must have been 10 years old, and I have not stopped since. So it was very difficult for me to accept the dictates of a society where a very rigid social class obtained.
Would you like to see Aristide become president again?
Well, he has to become president again because he was elected. It never occurred to me, when we had a series of presidents in the United States, for me to beg Colin Powell to intervene. It never occurred to me. I don't think it ought to occur to anyone. President Aristide was elected with a higher percentage of the vote than any elected president in the Western Hemisphere. That includes Bill Clinton and all the presidents in Latin America. Highest percentage. So whether one likes him or one doesn't like him is quite irrelevant. I have not liked an American president since Kennedy. But I would not dream of asking for military, U.S. military intervention against the White House. Mm-hmm. Never dream of it.
I want to thank you very much for talking
about
this.
Thank you.
Patrick Bellegarde-Smith directs the Department of Africology at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's the author of Haiti, The Breached Citadel. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, what Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie have to say about the power of women. We talk with Susan Douglas, author of Where the Girls Are, her new book about growing up female with the TV on. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the Rolling Stones' new album, Voodoo Lounge. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Haitian leaders are now threatening to punish any citizen who supports a foreign invasion of Haiti. They're also pulling diplomatic passports issued under the previous government backed by ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This announcement comes after President Clinton alluded to the possibility of a U.S. military invasion to restore democracy in Haiti, and the president's comments were spurred by the Haitian military leader's decision to expel human rights observers from the United Nations. The observers have until tomorrow to leave the country. The Senate Judiciary Committee is considering the Supreme Court nomination of Judge Stephen Breyer. Breyer gave an opening statement today, saying he believes the law should work for everybody, and he's promised that if confirmed, he'll try to be worthy of its traditions.
I will work hard. I will listen. I will try to interpret the law carefully, in accordance with its basic purposes. Above all, I will remember that the decisions I help to make will have an effect upon the lives of many, many Americans.
Breyer is expected to be confirmed. The committee's ranking Republican, Orrin Hatch of Utah, endorsed Breyer even before he was nominated. President Clinton told the people of Berlin today that the German capital will be at the heart of a new Europe of free and democratic nations. The president spoke in former East Berlin after walking with German Chancellor Helmut Kohl through the Brandenburg Gate, during the Cold War years symbolized the city's division. We have more from the BBC's Carolyn Wyatt in Berlin.
The center of Berlin came to a standstill as President Clinton walked through the Brandenburg Gate, the first American leader to be able to address the United City of Berlin. Thousands of people had waited for several hours in the blazing heat to witness his speech at the eastern side of the gate, which once stood at the wall dividing east from west. A huge cheer went up as Mr. Clinton began by praising the courage of the Berliners themselves. They had, he said, proved that no wall could contain what he called the mighty power of freedom.
Carolyn Wyatt reporting. Shareholders of United Airlines parent company have approved an employee buyout of the carrier. This creates one of the nation's largest employee-owned businesses. UAL Corporation Chairman Stephen Wolf says the purchase was approved after all the mail-in votes were counted. Residents of Bainbridge, Georgia, are watching the Flint River continue to rise. It's not clear what kind of damage the floodwaters will leave behind. More than a third of the city's 10,000 residents have fled their homes, and the rain-swollen river will not crest until Thursday. On Wall Street today, stocks closed mixed. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost a fraction of a point to end at 3,702.66. Advances edge declines. This is NPR. The government has released good economic news. Wholesale prices for June were unchanged. Food prices stayed the same, and energy costs rose slightly. The inflation reading is better than most economists had expected. The Labor Department says for the first 6 months of this year, the producer price index has risen 1.6%. Wholesale prices declined in the two previous months. The so-called core rate of inflation fell 0.1% in June, after jumping 0.4% in May. The consumer inflation report comes out tomorrow. Reports from Algeria say there's been another violent attack linked to suspected Islamic militants who have been targeting foreign nationals as well as members of Algiers' security forces. The BBC's Alfred Hermida reports from Algiers.
The latest wave of attacks by suspected Islamic militants appears to signal the start of a new offensive against the military-led government. In the space of a week, 14 foreigners have been killed, 7 of them in the capital, Algiers. Today's attack outside the Italian embassy in Algiers seems calculated to prove that after more than 2 years of tough repressive measures, the authorities are still no closer to stamping out the Islamic insurgency. The violence started out as a confrontation between the security forces and supporters of the main opposition party, the Islamic Salvation Front, which was poised to win elections until they were cancelled by the military. But since then, the conflict has spiraled out of control, with civilians and foreigners caught up in the violence. The continued unrest has led to the rise of extremist Islamic groups, which are leading a ruthless campaign of assassinations and sabotage aimed at toppling the government.
Al Fermita reporting. Burundi's highest court has extended the interim president's term in office. Rival political parties are trying to reach a deal on a new government. The justices of Burundi's court feared that a bloodbath might break out. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Did you ever think the perkiness of Gidget and Patty Duke were actually assertiveness masquerading as cuteness? It's something Susan Douglas considers in her new book, Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. She grew up watching fairy tale princesses, beach bunnies, witches, flying nuns, bionic women, beauty queens, and mothers who cleaned the house in spotless dresses. Douglas thinks TV, movies, and records gave girls lots of mixed messages, but they helped make her a feminist. She describes her new book as a tour through the images of the past 4 decades in which she reviews and makes fun of the media-induced schizophrenia so many women feel. She has a love-hate relationship with some TV shows, like Charlie's Angels, which premiered in the wake of the women's movement.
I remember two things about Charlie's Angels back in 1976. One is that I, like many other feminists, deplored the wet T-shirts, the hip huggers, the string bikinis, and the fact that Charlie's voice came out through the boombox to tell them what to do.
Can I just stop you and mention the hairdos? Okay.
Oh, the hairdos, yes. And there was a lot of writing up about how long it took to get the hair just perfect, right? We're talking like 3 hours with the hairdressers to get the perfectly flouncy, bouncy look that the angels had. Okay, so yeah, there was a lot that was retrograde about the show. The other thing I remember about it is I watched it every Wednesday night, and so did millions of American women. And so when I wanted to explore this contradiction as I went back to write about it for the book, and what I found that I have to confess, completely forgotten is that once Charlie's voice is off of the boombox, and they are out of the office and away from Dumbo Bosley, what's going on here is that there are three women working together. They actually use on-screen deductive and inductive reasoning to figure out who the bad guy is and why he is behaving the way he is. They refer to many of these bad guys as male chauvinist pigs, and they use their guns to rescue themselves and each other. So you see a lot of very powerful feminist moments in a show that is wrapped up in the most anti-feminist packaging.
I guess I'm too cynical to see those things as feminist moments. I'm so cynical I see it as some scriptwriter thinking, yeah, and we'll throw in a couple of male chauvinist pigs and words like that, and, you know, maybe that'll help us in the ratings.
Oh,
or maybe it'll help us pose as a feminist show.
Oh, well, you know, I think one always has to separate out intention from result. And the intentions may have been as cynical as you've just described them, absolutely. I mean, you know, these guys were no fools. They were going after the young female market, and they knew that the women's movement had made a difference for these young women in terms of how they viewed the world. On the other hand, it was clear that most of us were not going to give up nice clothes and nice hair. We've just been socialized too long that way. But I think that you have to separate out the intention of the producers, which may have indeed been quite cynical, from the way the show was regarded. And to see for an hour on television three women, string bikinis or not, working together, often to help some other woman who was usually of a lower class than they, save her sister or, you know, get some information or save her job or whatever, was as strangulated and constricted as it was uplifting for some of us. I mean, there are very few shows still on television today where there are three women working together to get the bad guys, and they did it.
One of the things you did for your book was to go back and look at the early news coverage of the women's movement. What are some of the things that struck you going back?
Well, the kinds of things that got said on television back then by male commentators would hopefully get them fired today. Ms. Magazine was dismissed when it came out by Harry Reasoner as kind of tabloid trash. In editorials on the nightly news, it was speculated that if the Equal Rights Amendment really passed, that this would solve once and for all the question about whether the United States would be the policeman of the world, since half the regiment, the female half, could never be ready on time to get any place. I mean, these were the kinds of things, they were part and parcel of the news coverage of the period. There was an enormous amount of ridicule and condescension about the women's movement. But the other thing that happened in the news coverage was that there were sympathetic moments. There were opportunities for feminists to have platforms from which they could address millions of women who barely knew a feminist movement was starting. And so, again, the media coverage was a real double-edged sword. On the one hand, it really constricted what was possible through feminism. On the other hand, it brought to the attention of millions of men and women in the country the fact that there was a women's movement, that women's private concerns were not personal or individualized, they were part of larger societal problems, and that there was a movement out to change that. So I think that the media coverage of the women's movement, while primarily retrograde in the extreme, also had some very important positive political effects.
You think that the news media today are schizophrenic about feminism?
Yes, I do. I think that the legacy from the coverage of the 1970s still lives with us today. If you say you're a feminist, you get the whole stereotype that goes with that, which means that you are an anti-fashion, child-hating, man-hating, makeup-loathing, humorless, strident harridan from hell. And, you know, this stereotype is incredibly resilient and has been over the years. So to identify yourself as a feminist carries, baggage with it that who wants to take that on?
Do you have any idea how the image of feminism became this stereotype that you just described?
Yeah. There was a great deal of institutional sexism in the news media, and you had male editors telling reporters to go out and find experts who would denounce the women's movement as, and I use paraphrase their terms, you know, a load of crap. And so they would find various sociologists who would say that feminists were maladjusted, that they hated men, that what they were really trying to do was compensate for the fact that they were terribly unattractive. These sorts of things got printed in sidebars in national magazines that sought to document the various ways in which feminists were, misguided. The other most popular illustration for any story about feminism was a woman doing black belt karate, especially if she was performing it on a man. And again, there were male editors who were reported as saying at the time, go get pictures of bra burning and karate. And the karate chopping image was prevalent. So then there were caricatures that were drawn of feminists. There was a very famous one that appeared in Esquire, and Esquire used to have images of these beautiful peach-toned nudes with a little poem, you know, about they were January's girl or something. And what they printed in the January 1971 issue was a parody of the pinup, and it was a feminist. And she had, you know, Roman centurion sandals on and baggy watermelon breasts and a look that could, you know, basically blast the testicles off of any man. And she was fearsome. And this was the feminist. Then this image got reproduced elsewhere, including in Time magazine. So I do have to point to the news media as playing a very important role in perpetuating this particular stereotype of a feminist.
My guest is Susan Douglas. She's the author of the new book, Where the Girls Are, Growing Up Female with the Mass Media. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about growing up female with the mass media. My guest is Susan Douglas. A lot of the old shows that you write about in your new book, shows from the 50s and 60s, are back on the air again, mostly on cable television. So a lot of the stereotypical images of women are you know, back on TV again. And some people watch it for nostalgia, and other people are seeing it for the first time around. I wonder if you think that, say, the Donna Reed image has a different impact now when people see it as reruns in the 90s than when it played the first time around.
Well, I think that the more that what is particularly interesting now is, and this has been going on especially on Nickelodeon, is the revival of Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. And what's interesting about these shows have been two of the longest, most widely syndicated shows on all kinds of stations throughout the country. So people know these shows, and yet now Nickelodeon is making a splash by re-airing the early seasons of Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, I think to great fanfare and great success. And these shows, the way in which they speak to a combination of the traditional woman at home who wants to please her husband, and yet who just can't quite stick to it because she has these magical powers and because she wants to break out of the home. I think that tension still speaks to people today. Granted, in an incredibly kitschy, you know, silly sort of way, but the metaphorical acting out of this tension, and people can inoculate themselves by laughing at it, but there it is. And I think that tension still speaks to people quite a bit.
Okay, well, let's go deeper into Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie. What's the different ways that Jeannie and Samantha use their witchy powers?
Well, Samantha aired first. The Bewitched was premiered in 1964, and it was a blockbuster for ABC. It was a huge hit and second only to the Western of Westerns, Bonanza. And when this show aired, it showed a domestic housewife, a young housewife, trying to do all of the traditional things that a young housewife would do. But at the same time, of course, she had this problem. She was a witch. Now, what we see in the early episodes of this show is that Samantha uses her witchcraft to expose corrupt politicians, to help her husband's ad campaigns, to fly to Paris with her mother for lunch, to instruct a dress designer on how to design real clothes for real American women instead of models. So there are a host of ways in which Samantha uses her magical power to intervene in the world and to have some agency in the world. And she's very much set up as an extremely sensible, smart person, much smarter and more inventive than her dumbo husband, Darren.
What about Jeannie?
Now, Jeannie is a different story. Jeannie is a warning. Jeannie is almost a backlash to Bewitched. Jeannie shows what happens when women get power, and it's a warning. Even the manned space program is no match for a woman with too much power. And she is a kind of femininity run amok. She uses her power primarily in a very petulant way to get back at Major Nelson if she's feeling possessive or jealous or neglected. She's often angry with him because he's not devoting enough time to her and too much time is to his job. And so there's not the same kind of intervention in the world. Of course, all you'd have to do is take one look at the two of them and see the little harem outfit with the, you know, pom-poms dangling off of it to know that Jeannie and Samantha are two very different kinds of witches with magic power.
What shows on television now say the most to you about how women are seen and portrayed in the mass media?
I think that, well, I tend to look at what shows are most popular in part because I want to see what most people are watching. I think that Roseanne and Murphy Brown have been very important shows for a variety of reasons, but they've given platforms to mouthy women, and that's been key. On the other hand, I think a real zeitgeist show right now is Melrose Place, which has had such enormous popularity. And I think the reason it's hit such a nerve is that, like soap operas before it, whether they were Dallas or Dynasty, it navigates that turbulent water between feminism and anti-feminism. It's got real bad villainesses. It's got good girls. It deals with feminist issues on the one hand, and yet shows that sometimes when women get power, it's bad. And it's really smack dab in the middle of that brew in which feminism and anti-feminism roil together, and viewers pull out of it what they can as they're kind of cobbling together their own responses to how to be in the world.
Okay, well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Susan Douglas is the author of Where the Girls Are. She's a professor of media and American studies at Hampshire College. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll have news today of President Clinton's speech in Berlin, Terry, and also some thoughts on past presidential speeches there, as well as the current state of U.S.-German relations. News of United Nations actions regarding Haiti. We'll hear about the confirmation hearings of Stephen Breyer, nominated to the Supreme Court by President Clinton, a report by Nina Totenberg, also from the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Two different treatments, as you can imagine, of that story. And also a report from John McChesney today with a slice of life online, comments on The Well, the computer bulletin board based in San Francisco.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Rolling Stones' first studio album since 1989 is just out today. It's called Voodoo Lounge. Beginning August 1st, the Stones will start a worldwide tour to promote the album. Here's rock critic Ken Tucker's review.
I was a butcher caught in a meat. My hands were bloody. I'm dying on my feet. I was a surgeon till I stopped to shake.
In the 80s, the Rolling Stones tended to get in a mood and play it out over the course of an album. They were Randy on Tattoo You, Weary on Undercover, Bitter on Dirty Work, for instance. On Voodoo Lounge, however, producer Don Was doesn't permit these still spunky old fogies such self-indulgence. As he did with Bonnie Raitt, Was insists that these veteran musicians ring fresh changes on a variety of familiar styles. Frequently, this strategy works.
Well, I said, from the first, I'm the worst kind of guy for you to be around. Tear me apart, baby, including this heart that is true, and never ever let you down. You shouldn't stick with me. Trust me too much, you think. Take all the pain, it's yours anyway. Get out, kid.
That's Keith Richards pouring his heart out in a song called The Worst. Voodoo Lounge features particularly strong work from Richards, both on guitar and vocals. He really sounds like a geezer who's been revitalized. This is the first Stones album recorded since bassist Bill Wyman quit the band. His place is taken here by Daryl Jones, who delivers a workmanlike, understandably humble performance. This ends up emphasizing the other half of the rhythm section, drummer Charlie Watts. It's a cliche by now to call Watts the best drummer in rock and roll, but really, listen to his playing on Sparks Will Fly and tell me that's not true.
You better grease up. I'm coming back. Gonna catch fire.
As for Mick Jagger, well, I'd say he's at his best when his jaded cynicism is given free rein, as it is on that song and another called I Go Wild. But even Jagger recognizes that being cruel and lewd has its limits after 30 years or so, and some of his best moments here at least feign tender concern awfully well. If there's any hoodoo involved in Voodoo Lounge, it's that the Stones sound spunkier, more engaged, than most bands half their age.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlee, Sue Spolin, and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Mark Tullis. I'm Terry Gross.
Sweethearts together, we've only just begun. Sweethearts together, we'll take life as it comes. Sweethearts forever, two hearts together as one. Everybody needs someone to tell their troubles to, share the pain and laughter in a world beset with fools, to help you with your ups and downs.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Nelson Peary traveled across America as a hobo, then enlisted during World War II and served as a black man in the segregated army. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Peary about his memoir, Black Fire, The Making of an American Revolutionary. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.